Thank you for being here. And I'm especially glad you are, because I have a big announcement. We are starting a patron program. I would be thrilled if you'd consider becoming a patron, or as I like to think of it, a member, of the British History, Royals, Rebels, and Romantics family. I have some amazing ways to show my appreciation, including some gorgeous designs by our own creative director, Lindsay Lindstrom, as well as early access to special episodes, exclusive content, and a chance to come on the show and ask your questions. Please visit my website, carolannloyd.com/podcast, to check it out and join us. If you have any questions, just let me know. This is new for us, so we'll be making changes and adding benefits soon. We hope you'll join us on our journey. And now, on to today's episode. In 1558, a small book made a big claim, the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women. John Knox engaged in an unrelenting attack on the very notion that a woman could rule a country. The phrase monstrous regiment means unnatural rule, which is what Knox claimed it was for a woman to be in a position of authority. It went against God's will, as the Maker clearly gave the ability to rule to the superior male sex. Women were weak, foolish, cruel, and depraved. Knox pulled no punches. He stated, quote, "How abominable before God is the empire or rule of wicked women," and went on, quote, "I am assured that God hath revealed unto some in our age, it is more than a monster in nature that a woman shall reign and have empire above man." Female rule is, according to Knox, repugnant to nature, contumely to God, and the subversion of good order, of all equity, and justice. The greatest perfection of women, in case you were wondering, quote, "was made to serve and obey man, not to rule and command him." You get the idea. A few royal women took exception to Knox. In fact, they proved him wrong. And we're considering two of those royal rebels today, Elizabeth I, and, of course, Mary, Queen of Scots. Because you really can't have a month about Elizabeth I without taking a look at the Queen of Scots. Blast against the monstrous rule of women, John Knox may have taken the idea that it was an abomination for women to rule to new lengths, but the feeling was not unique to him. Lots of people were concerned. In the view of many, two women ruling was two women too many. It was the second queen regnant in succession in England when Elizabeth took the throne, and Mary I's reign had produced mixed results. Many in England were anxious about Elizabeth coming to the throne, wondering what lay ahead. Scotland had experienced religious and political turmoil while their young queen had been growing up in France. And when she returned after the death of her husband François in 1560, people weren't certain how she and her lords would respond to the transition of power from a Protestant Earl of Moray to a Catholic queen. So people were concerned. Too many reigning women. And that might be one of the reasons they are almost always compared to and put in competition with each other. Yes, Mary, Queen of Scots claimed Elizabeth's throne right from the start. But for several years, the two women ruled alongside each other, Mary in Scotland and Elizabeth in England. It's definitely true that Elizabeth's throne wasn't large enough for both of them, but Britain was, and our discussion is. So let's spend today talking about the legacies of both women, celebrating both women, and giving both women credit for what they accomplished. First, let's use Knox to set the stage. John Knox was targeting three Catholic female rulers when he wrote his book. Mary, Queen of Scots, who was at the time living in France and betrothed to the heir to the French throne. Marie of Guise, who was ruling Scotland as regent on behalf of her daughter. And Mary I of England. Mary I was the most direct target because of her persecution of Protestants in England. But instead of focusing on the religion of the three queens, Knox attacked them because of their gender. Knox was writing for a society that relied on the traditional conservative beliefs where life was structured to reinforce patriarchal control. The notion of rule and monarchy was based on male primogeniture, and everything from the traditional ceremonies associated with the coronation to the format of coins and seals to the structure of church and society assumed that men would always be in charge. Knox may have intended his work to challenge the Catholic rule of Mary I, but it was Protestant Elizabeth I who came to the throne the year his first blast was published. Marie of Guise died 2 years later. That left two women who were poised to rule England and Scotland for years to come, Mary Queen of Scots and Elizabeth I. These two women had been linked from early in their lives. On the 9th of September, 1543, Mary was crowned Queen of Scotland. She had been queen since the death of her father, James V, when she was just 6 days old. Her mother and the lords had waited a few months for the coronation. With Henry VIII making noise about getting his hands on the baby queen as a bride for young Prince Edward, the Scots seemed to think that Mary needed to be crowned and established. Her coronation was just 2 days after Henry VIII's younger daughter turned 10 years old. Born as a princess and demoted to a lady after the fall of her mother Anne Boleyn, Elizabeth was living generally away from court, living as the daughter, but not the heir, of the king. Both Elizabeth and Mary had been disappointments to their fathers because they were girls. Henry VIII had taken the very unpopular step of ending his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, disinheriting his daughter Mary, breaking with Rome and the Pope, and establishing himself as the supreme head of the Church of England. Also, he could marry Anne Boleyn and have a son. Anne had promised him a son, and when she got pregnant quickly, it seemed she'd made good on that promise. On September 7th, 1533, the baby arrived, and it was a girl. The king and queen put on a brave face, but it was a blow to Henry's plans. He had counted on the birth of a prince, proving that his decisions were God's will. 9 years later, in 1542, Marie of Guise was about to have a baby as well. She and James V had recently lost their two sons. James had also experienced a humiliating loss to the English at the Battle of Solway Moss. The birth of a daughter was the final blow. The King of Scotland is reported to have moaned, "It began with a lass, it will pass with a lass," and turn his head to the wall and die. Unlike her Tudor cousin, Mary quickly became the monarch. She inherited her father's throne on the 14th of December, 1542. Both Elizabeth and Mary lost access to their mothers early on. Elizabeth's mother was executed in May 1536, 4 months before Elizabeth turned three. Her mother's fall from favor had been dramatic and violent, with Anne Boleyn accused of multiple acts of adultery with five different lovers. This allowed some people to claim Elizabeth wasn't even the king's daughter at all, something her own half-sister did several times. Elizabeth was also linked to and accused of inheriting her mother's immoral nature. Mary's mother was a supportive presence in the early years of her daughter's life, and she was determined to protect her young daughter from the clutches of Henry VIII. So Marie of Guise arranged for the young Scottish queen to travel to France and be raised in the French court as the betrothed of the Dauphin, who was heir to the French throne. Mary was the center of attention at the glamorous, elegant French court, adored by the Dauphin and the other royal children, and celebrated by the courtiers. She was pampered and praised and given anything she wanted. Henri II of France watched the English monarchy with interest. As did many Catholics in Europe, the French king had opposed Henry VIII's marriage to Anne Boleyn and did not consider Elizabeth to be a true heir to the English throne, even though Henry VIII, by the end of his life, returned her to the line of succession. If Elizabeth were to be eliminated from the line of succession, the next in line would be the descendant of Henry VIII's elder sister Margaret, who just happened to be the young woman in the French court preparing to marry his son. Henri II moved up the wedding, and by the time Mary I of England died in 1558, Francois and Mary Queen of Scots were married. The two of them claimed the English throne. Contemporary reports describe the young Mary as acting out her claim, insisting that her herald precede her as she walked through the palace corridors crying, "Make way for the Queen of England!" When Henri II died unexpectedly in 1559, Francois and Mary became king and queen of France, Scotland, and England. At least that's what the coins and the badges and the coats of arms and the royal seals said. The claim did not go unnoticed by Elizabeth and the English. Little more than a year later, Mary's charmed life was crushed by the death of her beloved husband. Francois's younger brother became king, and his mother, Catherine de' Medici, took over control of the court. Catherine was just about the only person in the French court not charmed by Mary, Queen of Scots, and she made it pretty clear she did not wish her daughter-in-law to remain in France. So Mary returned home to Scotland to begin her active rule. That means in 1561, there were two women ruling side by side in England and Scotland. Elizabeth had been on the throne for 3 years. She had established a middle way in England with a hope of calming the chaos and turmoil that had accompanied the religious extremism of Mary I and Edward VI. Her pragmatic approach to religion meant she kept Catholics on her privy council as well as Protestants, and focused on the behavior rather than the beliefs of her subject. As Francis Bacon is reported to have said of her, she didn't want to make windows into men's souls. Mary also initially took a pragmatic approach to religion. Catholics in Scotland were hoping that her return would represent a major change in the government and a surge of Catholicism across the country. They were to be disappointed. Mary kept all the Protestant lords in power and sought to work closely with the Earl of Moray, her Protestant half-brother. He was the illegitimate son of James V. When Catholic powerhouse Lord Huntly led a rebellion, Mary joined forces with Moray against him. She was committed to policies that strengthened ties to England rather than those that promoted Catholicism in Scotland. She was also willing to leave all the Protestants in power. This indicates to historians like Jemmy Wormald that Mary was already starting to focus on the English throne. Mary sent William Maitland of Lethington, a known Protestant, as her ambassador to England, asking him to convince Elizabeth to officially name Mary as the heir to the English throne. This was important to Mary. However, Elizabeth was unwilling to name a successor. She had experienced the reality of people at court turning toward her as her half-sister Mary neared death. As she described it, people prefer the rising to the setting sun. In other words, naming an heir might lessen her popularity and power. As a monarch who made much of the goodwill of her people, Elizabeth was unwilling to make that concession. Mary continued to pressure Elizabeth and wrote letters asking for a meeting and a closer relationship with her sister queen. At the same time, she was pursuing another goal, an advantageous marriage. Mary, Queen of Scots, had already been married to the King of France, and she sought a similar situation. However, her attempts to arrange a marriage with the son of Philip of Spain were put down by Philip himself. Her Guise relatives in France attempted to arrange a marriage to the Archduke Charles of Austria, but Mary herself refused that one. She was willing to consider an appropriately ranked Protestant, but no one seemed available. Elizabeth wanted to be involved and offered, although it's hard to say how seriously, her own BFF Robert Dudley, having made him Earl of Leicester. Mary rebuffed this offer. For whatever reason, during the husband hunt, Elizabeth allowed her cousin, Henry Stuart Lord Darnley, who was the son of Margaret Douglas and the grandchild of Margaret Tudor, as was Mary herself, to travel to Scotland. Mary, Queen of Scots, was immediately smitten by the long lad, as she called him, and quickly arranged to marry him. This is often pointed to as a disastrous choice by Mary, and it certainly turned out to be. But in some ways, it also demonstrates her grit and determination to control her life and refuse to be pushed around by her lords or the English queen. She married Darnley against everyone's wishes. Yes, it turns out it would have been much better if she had taken some time to get to know him before she married him. But there was something powerful about her taking control of her life. Elizabeth was doing the same thing in a different way. From her first parliament, her lords and privy council had been encouraging, begging, haranguing her to marry. The ongoing debate was around which suitor the queen would marry, not if the queen would marry. Elizabeth considered, prevaricated, delayed, and then gently turned down offer after offer. By doing so, she managed to keep her international suitors happy enough to preserve the peace across the nation, and her English courtiers satisfied and in line as well. Early on, the queen said she would never marry. No one took her seriously. But her statement that she would have but one mistress and no master at court turned out to be a tenet of her reign. In Mary's case, the marriage to Darnley turned out to be complicated, to say the least. She became pregnant quickly, but before her child was born, Darnley had turned against her, and along with the lords, had burst in upon Mary's private dinner and murdered her friend and secretary, David Rizzio. They took Mary captive. Mary managed to get Darnley back on her side and to escape the lords with the help of her supporter, Lord Bothwell. But the marriage continued to falter. When Mary's baby was born on the 19th of June, 1566, everything changed again. Although the birth of a son was typically considered to be the crowning glory of a king's reign, certainly it was the highlight of Henry VIII's, it could be different for a queen. After all, men were preferable to women on the throne, and that included even very young men. Having a son was a triumph for Mary, but it would also provide another option for monarch when people turned against her. The royal marriage came to a violent end on the 10th of February, 1567, when the house where Darnley was staying, Mary having left to spend the night elsewhere, blew up. Darnley wasn't killed in the explosion. He had apparently heard something suspicious and tried to escape. His body was found in the garden. He had been strangled. It was clearly murder. Elizabeth was appalled at the murder of her, quote, poor killed cousin, as she called him, and began to counsel Mary how to respond to avoid any scandal. As suspicion centered on Mary's longtime supporter, Lord Bothwell, the Scottish queen became embroiled in the fallout. Bothwell was cleared at a hasty trial, and he managed to secure the support of the lords and bishops in his desire to marry the queen. He took Mary, either by force or agreement, and they were married on May 15th in a Protestant ceremony. Bothwell expected the lords to continue to support his marriage, but his arrogance and desire for power put them off. Both Catholics and Protestants were troubled by the marriage, which became a growing problem for Mary. Eventually, the lords captured the pair and forced Mary to abdicate in favor of her infant son. That baby, which could have represented Mary's future, became her replacement. It wasn't unheard of for a son to contest his father's reign, but it is significant that the baby boy was preferred to his royal mother. The kings of Europe were not forthcoming in support for Mary. The one royal who regularly spoke out in her favor and against the actions of the lords was her queenly cousin, Elizabeth I of England. Likely convinced by Elizabeth's support, Mary made another fateful decision. Showing extraordinary physical and emotional courage, she escaped from prison in Scotland and fled to England. Mary arrived in England in 1568, 10 years after Elizabeth took the throne. She had never officially retracted her claim to the English throne, and she continued to refuse to sign the Treaty of Edinburgh, which recognized Elizabeth as rightful queen. Now, she wanted Elizabeth to provide her an army and help her retake the throne in Scotland. It was a complicated request for Elizabeth. She was absolutely in favor of supporting an anointed queen, and the idea that the Lords could force a queen to abdicate her throne was a threat to Elizabeth's own hold on her throne. On the other hand, her parliament and council preferred to deal with the Protestant Earl of Moray, who was now ruling in behalf of James VI. Furthermore, Mary hadn't been officially cleared in the involvement in Darnley's murder. Elizabeth allowed her council to pursue a sort of prosecution of the Scottish queen. The case involved the so-called casket letters, a series of letters that supposedly tied Mary to Bothwell in planning the murder. The veracity of these letters has long been debated. The case found that nothing was proven against the Confederate lords or against Mary herself, creating a standoff, which was exactly what Elizabeth wanted. Moray continued in Scotland as regent, and Mary remained in England in custody. For the next 19 years, Mary was held in a series of properties in England, while relations between the two queens deteriorated. With Mary in England, Catholics throughout England and Europe began plotting to overthrow Elizabeth and install Mary on the English throne. Elizabeth's Catholic earls, led by the Duke of Norfolk, worked against their queen. A Catholic rebellion broke out in the north of England in 1569, just 1 year after Mary's arrival. The next year, the Protestant Earl of Moray was assassinated by Catholics. That same year, the Pope excommunicated Elizabeth and called on her subjects to replace the usurper queen with the true queen, Mary. Philip of Spain and Charles IX and then Henry III of France supported the Catholic rebellions as well, even going so far as to offer financial and military support. Now, Elizabeth had her supporters as well, William Cecil and Francis Walsingham in particular. In addition, the rest of her council supported the efforts of Cecil and Walsingham to convince the queen to take the danger seriously and move against the Queen of Scots. For years, Elizabeth refused, even as rebellions continued. Eventually, in 1586, Mary was involved in the Babington Plot, which was an attempt to assassinate Elizabeth, support the invasion of Spanish forces, put Mary on the English throne, and restore Catholicism to England. Mary agreed to the assassination, not aware that her letters were being intercepted and deciphered by Walsingham's agents. At this point, I want us to pause because I think one of the significant things about this whole time is the way that although forces were working against both women that they could not control, both of these women took control of their narratives and established lasting legends that helped shape history. Mary, although she had been a pragmatic Catholic when she first returned to Scotland, willing to work with Protestants in her council, now cast herself as a religious martyr. She took on the image of a devout and devoted religious woman suffering for her faith. She claimed she was being persecuted for her beliefs instead of prosecuted for participating in a plot to assassinate the English queen. She stood up to the accusers at her trial with extraordinary courage and spirit, refusing to even recognize their authority, as she was an anointed queen rather than an English citizen. Although it was clear by that point that Walsingham had the evidence to convict her, Mary maintained her innocence. Right up to the moment of her execution, she maintained her image as a Catholic martyr. In fact, the small detail of her fiery red hair turning out to be a wig wasn't known until after she'd been beheaded. The image she created lasted long beyond the end of her life. Likewise, by this point, Elizabeth was well into her reign, and it was clear she would not marry and produce an heir. Unlike Mary, Queen of Scots, who had a son, Elizabeth was childless. Unlike any queen regnant before or since, Elizabeth would spend her entire life and her entire reign as a single woman. She ruled on her own without the support of a man beside her. This was even more horrifying than the thought of a woman ruling in the first place. So Elizabeth created an image that made herself into a thing of veneration and near worship. She transformed into the Virgin Queen, associated with purity and caretaking. She effectively replaced the Virgin Mary as an object of worship. Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, decked in pearls and holding tokens like a sieve that were associated with legends of virginity. She had been on the throne so long, many of her subjects barely remembered a time when she wasn't queen. Her image, moving with grandeur and magnificence through the court, seemed timeless. As was the case with Mary, Queen of Scots, the image Elizabeth I created lasted long beyond her life. Of course, both narratives were more propaganda than reality, but that doesn't make them any less powerful. The real legacies of these two women is real. They changed the monarchy forever. As historian John Guy remarked, quote, "I realize that both Elizabeth and Mary, or as it might whimsically be said, both paid-up members of the Women's Monarch Trade Union, were actually on each other's side as women rulers," end quote. Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth I were not always in competition because both of them realized what many do not, that there was room for both of them. They were women in positions of power in a patriarchal society, and their lives were entwined from the beginning. Together, Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth I showed the world that women could rule. Thank you for joining us to talk about two royal women who refused to be limited by the likes of John Knox and other men of their time. I really appreciate your listening. Please take a moment to subscribe, leave a rating, and share with a friend. And please consider joining us by becoming a patron. I am thrilled to say that next week I'll be joined by the amazing historian and assistant curator at Hever Castle, Kate McCaffrey. She'll be sharing her new research and an exciting connection between Elizabeth I and her mother, Anne Boleyn. Please do join us.